You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Well, well, well. Daryl, I can't believe what you just told me.
What's that, Joe?
About Margaret Road Knight's introductory song. She is still alive. She's still performing. I think she's in her 80s.
Uh-huh.
She's a Melbourne icon. Considering all you did was beat a bloody drum, you're a percussionist, you know, she's done something in her life. Hey, Daryl, I understand you're going to the Sofitel tonight, mate. How come, what's happening?
Oh, look, nothing but the best, mate.
Yeah.
Best hotels in Melbourne will be set up at the footpath there.
Yeah, but I heard you were escorted out this morning by two detectives, mate.
Yeah.
What were you doing? What was going on?
Well, I was trying to case out the conference.
What, you wanted to steal the cutlery?
Well, I was going to take some pictures of some of the job provider heads there, I didn't get the chance when a couple of detectives approached me and escorted me out.
And they gave you an invitation to dinner tonight, did they, for the job providers?
No, you and your
mob are on the footpath.
Yeah.
Look, if you want to join Daryl on the footpath, have you got any food?
Yeah, we have a bit of food there.
All right.
And some drinks.
I'm worried about them. They'll be there, between 5:30 and 10?
Yeah, 5:30 till 10:30. Yeah. Till about 10:30.
Yeah,
tonight.
That's top end of Collins Street, obviously the Paris End. Where else?
25 Collins Street.
25.
Actually.
The Paris End, the top end near Parliament House.
Yeah.
It'd be nice to go and meet Daryl and all those unemployed lazabouts, hanging around outside the Sofitel while those wonderful people from the job providers, enjoy themselves.
As I make new plans to rip us off one way or another.
Look, mate, that's the way it goes. The good thing is we've actually got a real live guest this week. He didn't actually... He had two minds, didn't you, Alan?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, we have Mr. or is it Doctor?
It's actually Doctor.
Well, we've got Dr. Alan Cuthbertson. Cuthbertson. I can't believe it. I got it right, Alan.
Pretty good.
I was calling you John when you first came in.
Yes.
You got a brother called John.
I've got a brother called John, but he's over in Western Australia.
So what year were you born?
1952.
Oh, so yes, 73. 52. Well, I was born in 51, so you better show some respect for your elders. You're laughing at that, aren't you, Daryl?
Yeah.
And where were you born?
Out at the other side of Ballarat, the Burrumbeet.
Burrumbeet.
Burrumbeet, near the lake.
I know Burrumbeet.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you know Modesty Lane?
Well, no, I've never been that modest.
Modesty Lane is where I lived my first 18 years of my life.
So what, you were born at home?
Pretty much. Well, in Ballarat.
Yes. In Ballarat. Where?
The sheep farm.
The sheep farm.
Yeah, my dad was a ex-serviceman.
Right.
So he got a soldier settlement place.
Yep.
And grew sheep, wool mainly, for... It'll be 30 years probably.
So he was one of the few soldier settlements that actually survived and prospered.
Yes. Well, the first year, after the First World War, they had soldier settlement blocks.
Yeah.
But they tended to be too small.
Yep.
His was 500 acres and it was pretty good land. So he was able to make a good job of it.
So where did he fight in the World War II?
He was over in Egypt
with
the 458 Squadron. He was a mechanic for the squadron.
Right. And any uncles?
Oh, yes. I've got an uncle, my dad's brother.
Right.
Yep. And his sister, both of them have passed away.
Right.
And then on my mother's side, a couple of uncles as well.
Right.
They've passed away as well. So it's down to our generation now.
All I remember about Burrumbeet was the Burrumbeet Mansion. Is it still there?
The pub?
I don't know what it was. Yeah.
There's been a pub on the corner for years.
Is that what it is? Yeah.
The farmers would all meet down there on a Friday night.
Well,
6 o'clock closing at that time. After 6, they would... The publican would invite them in for drinks.
Would be, I think it was 71 or 72. That's the last time I was down at that pub, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
Not that I remember much of it. Maybe I got beaten up by the farmers. You know what it was like for draft resistors in those days. Now, you were born in 52. Where were your parents? Where did they come from?
Well, Dad came from Lake Learmonth. around the thing. His father had a farm out that way.
Right.
And so he was there. My mother came from Adelaide.
Uh-huh.
Her family was over there, and she was in the, during the war. She was a WAF, in the WAF.
Right.
And stationed at Ballarat.
Now, look, most of our listeners are under 20. And they wouldn't know what the WAF is.
The WAF, the Women's Air Force.
Yeah.
Or Women's Australian Air Force, yes.
Women's Australian. What role did she have in that? Do you
know? She was in the photographic section.
Right.
So the planes would fly along and take photos, and she'd have to publish them and get them all going.
So she was a spy.
Well, they used to take two photos.
Right.
And then they could make a 3D image of it to work out the heights and things.
Right, so, things, yeah. Oh. And any brothers and sisters?
Yes, I've got three brothers.
Right.
One's over in Western Australia, one's in Melbourne, and one's up in Brisbane.
Older or younger?
Two older and one younger.
So why did they disperse around the country?
Well, they probably just didn't like me to be too clear. No, it was just work mainly.
Work.
Yeah, right. My brother went over to Western Australia and set up a computing consultant company over there.
Oh, he's a genius.
Oh, he made a bit of money out of it. Yeah,
yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, he must have been at the at the beginning of it all.
Yes.
1990s. Yes. Yeah. And the other brothers, how?
One's up in Queensland. He's a geophysicist.
Right.
And so he's run around measuring all the earthquakes up around Brisbane.
Hang on, I was born in Brisbane in 51. What do you mean, earthquakes? I don't remember any earthquakes.
Well, their project was actually to go to all the dams, like the Russians Dam up there.
Oh, right.
And they would monitor earthquakes around that, because when you have a dam, it tends to make the earth move.
I didn't know that.
And so the earthquake, their monitoring was intended to detect when the dam was going to collapse.
That's very kind of them, isn't it, to know that? I'm sure most listeners wouldn't have known that when there's a dam.
There's a lot of weight in a dam.
Is there?
Yeah.
I thought it was all plastic.
Well, the wall and the water, they both add up.
Yeah, they do, yeah. I've noticed that. So, Cuthbertson, that's an interesting name. Where does that come from?
Well, it's Scottish, really.
What do you mean, really? Is it or isn't it?
It is Scottish.
Right.
My family came from there years ago. We haven't followed them back much. One of my brothers got back about three generations, I think it was.
Right. You're all.
But they were all in Australia by then.
So what, you're all serfs, most likely?
Yes.
You weren't chieftains or landowners?
No.
I assume you were just chucked off the land by the English when they invaded?
Something like that.
You weren't at the Battle of, what is it, Culloden? What was the battle, the big battle? Scottish history.
Scottish history,
yeah,
no.
Yeah. No, they were all slaughtered,
yes,
almost to a man and woman. Yeah. They cleared them. They cleared them. So then the Scots came here, and then they cleared the Aboriginals, so they knew what to do. You wouldn't believe it. If you look at the history of early Victoria and many of the people who perpetrated some of the worst massacres here in Victoria were actually victims of the, what they used to call, what was it called, when they just removed people from the Scots to bring in the sheep.
Right.
And the same thing happened here. They removed the Aborigines to bring in the sheep. The clearances. So you would have been most likely from that period.
Yes, probably.
So where does a young lad from Burrumbeat go to school?
I went to Brewster Primary School.
Brewster,
which had 14 kids there.
Is it still? Do you know if it's still open?
It was closed, and it was actually turned into a restaurant.
A restaurant?
Out in the middle of nowhere.
Right.
There was, Brewster consisted of the Brewster Hall,
yep,
the school residence and the school.
Right,
it was
right
at an intersection.
Yep.
And a couple started up the phone, a homosexual couple started up, which was interesting to have in outbacks of Ballarat at that stage.
Uh-huh.
Did an excellent job of it.
Uh-huh.
They grew herbs out the back and started up a wonderful thing. People drive, well, you had to drive a long way to get there.
Yeah.
So it had a pretty good reputation.
Is it still open?
No, it's closed down now.
It's closed down.
Yeah.
So the Brewster School no longer exists?
It may still be there, I don't know. I haven't been back that way for a long time.
Any reunions?
I went there probably 30 years ago to a reunion.
What was that like?
Oh, it was interesting to catch up with everyone. And
14 students?
Yeah, well, it's... Over the years.
Over the years, yeah. All right.
And all their parents came and all their years.
That's good. And what was it like being in a... I assume all the grades were in one classroom, weren't
all
they?
All in one room, yeah.
And you had one teacher?
One teacher. So you got the advantage that you could hear what was coming up next year.
All right.
So you'd sort of got a a flow of what it was. And if you didn't learn it one year, you could catch it up the next year.
And were your brothers at the school at the same time?
Well, one was 2 years ahead and one 3 years behind, and the other 4 years ahead. Yeah.
Hang on. So at one stage you made up over 35% of the school population.
Pretty much,
the Cuthbertsons. Yeah. Your own private school.
Yes, pretty much.
Yeah.
But the school teacher, he'd come over and then he'd go back for lunch and just leave us deserted at the school for lunchtime.
Well, what was going to happen? Somebody's going to kidnap you?
Well, if there was any fighting or anything, you had to trouble over to the teacher and he'd come back and sort it out.
Right, fighting amongst 14 students?
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Well, there's alliances all made up and everything.
Alliances? Like that. Yes. What was it based on?
Oh, I don't know. It depends on who was in the flavour of the month.
Oh, right. This is pretty pedestrian. But it really highlights a period of Australian history where you could get an education, and it was a good education.
It was a good education.
Yeah, a good public education.
Although you're a little bit... The problem would be is if you got a teacher who wasn't that good, you had him for 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
So it could impact you, but most of us managed pretty well.
Pretty well. And where did you go to high school?
Ballarat High School or Ballarat West High School.
How come your parents didn't send you to a private school, son?
Couldn't afford it.
Couldn't afford it. No. You had to rely on the public system.
That's right. And catch a bus to school each day. It took about, I think it was about an hour on the bus.
On the bus? What, the bus stopped near the farm?
Yeah, I had to walk to the front gate and catch the bus.
The whole four of you.
Yeah, and if you're quick, we could look up the road and see the bus coming. If you could see the bus coming, you're in trouble. You had to run.
You had to run. Well, it wouldn't stop.
Yeah.
Ah, oh, fair enough. So, what was life like at high school for you?
I studied very hard. I was a good boy at school. Never got into trouble. And worked pretty hard, and did pretty well.
Did you do anything on the sporting field?
No,
you would have been a bit of a loss, wouldn't you?
I was a terrible loss in sport. I tried playing footy, but that was too rough. I found if you could stay in the back quarter, the back pocket, ball didn't come near you, so you could sort of avoid it.
Yeah.
But I did take on hockey
for
a bit and played that a little bit. But then...
What's your shins like? Did you have pads?
Yeah, head pads. Oh, yeah, we're serious hockey players.
Serious?
Yeah. And then I took up a bit of tennis.
Tennis?
Tennis, and we're part of the Brewster tennis team.
The Brewster tennis team.
And there was me and my brother.
I just want to ask, what was the population of Brewster at this particular point in time?
Well, if you counted all the farms around, you'd probably get about 30.
30, and you got a tennis team out of that?
Yes, well, there's two from my family and four from the Swan family.
All right.
They were the skillful tennis players. We just made up the numbers.
All right. So you said, why did you study hard?
Because there's nothing else to do, I think.
Nothing else to do.
I always had that ethic that you worked hard.
Right.
Did what
that's the old there. That's the old Protestant Catholic.
Old Protestant. My father was a Presbyterian. My mother, Church of England.
Right. Did religion play any part in your life as a young lad?
Well, we went to church every Sunday.
Every Sunday.
Yes, and I became a Sunday school teacher.
Right. What was that like?
Oh, no, it was sort of just the thing to do. But then I came to confirmation classes. Got halfway through the confirmation classes and thought, I don't think I really believe this terribly well.
Do you well being so 14, 15, were you? 14 or 15, and you?
Failed confirmation classes.
You failed. You started your academic career by failing Look, I've met all types on this show. I've had people who have been expelled from kindergarten, but I've never had a guest who failed confirmation
class. It was hard work.
Hard work, yeah. Well, you just said, I don't believe this, and walked out.
It was the first time I'd sat down and thought about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was science-based back, and I just couldn't relate science and the religion, really.
Well, the seven-day creation theory wasn't your bag.
Didn't seem right.
And the dinosaur bones.
I wanted to see real proof that there was there, but anyway.
Well, that's your problem. See, the great thing about, as I tell people living at the end of the first quarter of the 21st century, is we don't have to rely on facts anymore. It's all about beliefs.
Yes.
You know, I mean, it's people like you that have caused the problems we have today. You lost faith. I mean, you got to believe, mate.
Yes.
I know I'm making fun of it, but this is a very serious thing. Same thing happened to me and a lot of other kids during that period, you know, that we just didn't see that religion had any real significance to us.
Well, that's right. I suppose I couldn't see why there had to be a religion.
Right.
It had just been thought up and it was a thought that had perpetuated.
Yeah, and what did your parents think about all this?
My mother was concerned. My dad wasn't too concerned. He wasn't really terribly religious. My mum was a religious one.
Right.
But they accepted it all right,
So you just stopped going to church?
Stopped going to church, yeah.
On Sunday, all right. So what year did you finish high school?
Oh, Well, I'd be 17 at the time, so I'd be just in
1970.
Yeah,
yeah. And well, you're a brilliant academic score.
I did reasonably well. Yeah. Got a scholarship to Melbourne Uni.
Ah, so you used the S word, didn't you? Scholarship.
That's right.
This was pre Whitlam 72, and the bright kids from the public sector. We get Commonwealth scholarships.
That's right, Commonwealth scholarships. I think it was about $4,000 a year or something.
Oh, it was a lot of money in those days.
A lot of money.
Because the average wage was about $100 a week.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was real money that you were paid to go to university. Mm-hmm. I assume you went to university, not tech college?
Melbourne, went to the Ormond College. I lived at Ormond College.
Hang on. How did you get money to live at Ormond College?
I got a scholarship there as well.
How did you swing that?
Oh, it's just nice to the master, I think. I don't know.
Did you do a written test?
I can't recall exactly how it happened. It just
You got free board and accommodation at Ormond College.
I think it was half board, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So you didn't have to work.
No.
You could just study.
Yep.
So what did you choose?
I started physics.
Physics.
A science degree, mastering in physics, yep.
A science degree, mastering in physics.
Yes.
I used to hate physics because it was so logical.
Physics is lovely. And what was the best part? My daughter did physics, 20, 30 years later.
Right.
And I went back and sort of helped her with it.
Right.
And I actually understood it the second time around.
Well, you didn't. You got your master's in physics but never understood it.
Well, I could understand what was happening at each, as you did each subject.
Yeah.
But when you go back and look at it again, you can see, this I can see where this is heading.
All right.
And then you then understood the path, if you like,
through
the physics degree.
Well, this sounds like a wonderful life, you know. Primary school, public high school, Commonwealth Scholarship, scholarship to Ormond College, Melbourne University. I assume you graduated with honours.
I went on to the PhD, actually.
Did a PhD. What was the PhD in?
In electron energy loss of titanium oxide.
Have you still got the original?
Yes, I've got the thing there. My wife typed it up for me when I was at uni. And
hang on. So when did you get married?
Yeah.
What year?
We were quite young. She was 18. I was 20, 21.
What happened?
Well, we met at college.
Oh, right.
She was one of the first women who joined Ormond College.
Right.
And so we met up there and hung out for a few years and then got married.
Got married, as you did in those days.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, obviously, the world kind of is swirling around you during this period, 1970, 71, 72, It's Time campaign, the draft resistors, the Vietnam moratorium. Did this all just go over your head?
Totally. I was very conservative in those days.
Yeah,
voted for the Liberals and thought they knew what they were doing. And thought that
you didn't vote for the country. Didn't vote for the Country Party.
No, I didn't vote for the Country Party. No,
just the Liberals.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I just put my head down and worked, I suppose.
Yeah. And what did you think of all those crazy kids on campus who'd go to protests?
Just ignore them. I do regret actually that I didn't get involved in those days. But I suppose I don't know whether I didn't have time or just wasn't interested. But I've never really been politically motivated that much.
Not during that period.
No.
So I just got to ask you a personal question. You don't have to answer. You and your wife, what's her name?
Margaret.
You and Margaret got married.
Yep.
Did you share a room at Ormond College or they kick you out?
We got married and moved into the married quarters.
Oh, the married quarters.
At Ormond College.
Yeah. Did you get a scholarship too for the Ormond College?
No, she didn't. She had richer parents than me.
Oh, right. Okay, yeah. That resolved that
Her problem. Parents sent her down because they thought she could be, she'd be safe at Ormond College. She didn't know I was there.
This is, I can't go on. This is young woman, 18, goes to Ormond College, meets physics genius. All right, you get a PhD.
She was rather interesting because she was just turned 18.
Yeah.
And I proposed to her at night time.
Yeah.
And next morning she rang up her mother and said that I'd proposed to her and then burst into tears. And her mother said, "You didn't say no, did you?"
Well, you must have made a good impression.
I made a good impression on her mother.
Oh, God. Yeah, this is a perfect life. The whole world goes past. Melbourne University. I think was Farrago was the magazine?
Yes.
Yeah. Protests on campus, draft resistors, police on campus, moratoriums, one side wrong, one side right, victory to the Viet Cong. None of this got to you.
No.
All right.
I even believed in the domino theory in those days.
And you're still voting Liberal?
Yep.
Okay. So Liberal. So you voted for McMahon in 72?
That'd be right.
There's all types, Daryl. All types. We've got one here. Okay. I mean, McMahon was the joke. He was a joke. He really was. Yes. He really. And you still voted for him.
Yes.
You believe.
He had a funny high voice.
Yeah. Poor bloke. And a funny wife. Now, Sonia, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
Now, so what happens to a young graduate who's married with a PhD?
Well, I went out and I was trying to get a job in computing because I did a bit of computing in my physics degree.
Right.
I couldn't get a job. I mean, my training was basically in electron energy analysis,
mm-hmm.
and there's not many jobs around that in Melbourne.
I wouldn't even know
so
what
I got
it
a
is.
Job at BP.
BP.
And the first job I got, the guy who was a bit of a snob when it came to academics,
yeah.
and he said, if you've got a PhD, I'll give you a job.
Right.
And that was it, basically.
And what did you do?
I was programming. It was a special program they had to control the flow of oil through the refinery.
Right.
So it would work out what extracts could come off where and make it the most efficient way of doing it.
And you felt this was your life.
That's right.
You?
Looking back now, I'd never go and work at BP. They'd be the definite enemy.
So how long did you stay with them?
Oh, it's about 5-6 years.
And then
in the physics.
Any kids in between?
Trying to think when the kids came. Yeah, that's well. There would have been one about that time came along. Yeah.
Right. So why did you leave BP?
Well, I went contracting as a computer programmer or a consultant in those days.
Oh, you were following your brother John, were you?
That's right.
He made the money, you didn't. Is that what happened?
I made reasonable money out of it. Because those are the days when they couldn't. The public service couldn't pay high rates for computer people.
Mm-hmm.
The only way they get pay them enough to get people to join them mm-hmm. was to give them contracts.
Right.
So I was on contract for a few years, yeah.
And after that?
Well, I went on, moved around. I think it was BP. I worked at a few companies and just kept working.
And voting Liberal?
No, by that stage I would have swapped over to Labor.
Why would you have done that?
Well, the thing that really pissed me off was that they had a thing there where they'd talked about taxation
mm-hmm.
and how you should index taxation.
Yep.
And then the Liberals suddenly decided they wouldn't index taxation and bring in bracket creep.
Right.
And
right.
I thought that was pretty unreasonable.
Bringing
they couldn't be honest about it. If they wanted to increase taxes, they should tell us.
You were just thinking of your own bloody pocket. That's
possibly
all it was.
As well.
You know, just another greedy worker.
Greedy capitalist.
Yeah, no, just another greedy worker. You weren't a capitalist.
Mm.
You didn't have your own. You weren't employing people, were you?
Not then.
No, not then.
I ended up with a business.
I don't know this bloke, Daryl. Did you pick this bloke, or where did we find him?
Oh, I've got no idea, John.
Yeah, I think I ran into him at John Englert's funeral.
That'd be right.
And people said, you need to speak to this bloke.
Well, you see, they don't know my background either.
No, nobody else does, but now it is.
They just think I'm a radical forever.
Yeah, well, you're not. That's what I want to show people. People can come from all different. A Liberal Party, a Liberal voting employer, brilliant. All right, okay. Now, when did the turning point come? Not just the bracket creep. When did the turning point come that you thought there was a life outside work and being a good boy?
Well, it was a series in The Age.
The Age? You're going to blame The Age?
I was reading The Age in those days. Yeah. And there was a series on climate change, because I'd never heard of climate change.
A series of climate change?
The articles on climate change.
What year was this?
Oh, it'd be about 2003, I suppose.
And you're not going to tell me Looney did cartoons for it?
There was no cartoons, but I read those articles and I thought, gee, this is serious.
Uh-huh.
We're going to have to fix this.
You mean a newspaper actually...
Converted me.
Well, changed your direction in life. We don't use the word conversion.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a religious program.
Mm-hmm.
It's not on the road. You weren't converted on the road to Damascus or the road to climate change. You're a thinker.
Mm.
So what was it in the series of articles that actually got you interested?
Well, the fact that it was such a risk to our future.
What, climate change?
Climate change, and I sort of thought, well, this is pretty obvious. We just got to explain it to everyone.
Excuse me,
we'll
you thought it was obvious?
Once I read the article, it was obvious, because the science all sort of lined up.
Science?
Yes.
You're talking about science,
yes,
facts.
Yes. Well, as I said, I was a physicist originally, so I could sort of understand. I mean, I didn't fully understand and could work it out, but it all hung together, and it all made sense.
Right. I've heard people being converted when they read the Bible or the Quran or, you know, or the Hindu tracts or something, but I've never heard about somebody being converted by reading an article in The Age.
Yeah, it was a series of articles. It went on for about a week, I think.
A week.
Explaining how it was all worked out.
All right. Well, that's pretty radical in the 1980s, the climate change. I remember those periods because you had the anti-uranium movement, more movement against uranium mining. You had a lot of things happening at that time. You had people talking about decentralised energy. Not centralised energy.
Well, that's the thing. The answers have been around for a long time.
Well, they have. I remember.
It's just not worth. Yeah. Worth
I remember worth I was marching in Brisbane in 1974 under a self-managed energy systems, decentralised energy. All right, let's get back to you. I'm sure nobody's interested in what I've got to say. So how did this change your trajectory? It's one thing, you know, reading something and your mind being changed. Did you feel that you had to do anything?
I felt I had to do something about it. I mean, our generations were the one that caused it. We had to do something to solve it.
Excuse me, we caused it?
Well, our generations did, yes.
What do you mean?
Well, by just burning up all that fossil fuel, 20 tonnes a year each of us were burning up, having a great time doing it.
You mean going surfing on the Dole, you would burn up fossil fuel?
But you would have driven a car to get to the surf.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah.
You're trying to destroy my illusions about my teenage period.
You don't think you caused the problem?
No, of course not. No, no, we didn't cause any problems. We just acquired lots of money and deprived our kids and grandkids of
it. That's right.
Yeah, that's our generation, mate.
That's right.
Oh, we didn't think about collaterals, did we? No. All right, so what was the first action you took?
Well, actually, it was interesting. I was just thinking about it the other day. We made a human sign.
A human sign.
We basically, you know, you have the letters and get all the people to stand.
Were they naked or dressed? That's what
they were all dressed.
They're all dressed, right?
I think it was 350.org.
350.org.
And we did this on Princess Bridge.
Why did you do this?
Well, I was just a pawn doing.
Yeah, yeah, no,
I'm not sure. I can't even remember which letter it was.
But why?
I was managing one of the letters.
But why 350.org?
Well, it was probably one of the big organisations around then. And the idea of never going beyond 350 parts per million seemed like a good idea at the time. We're now pushing 430 or so.
430. Oh, you failed, didn't you?
We did. We failed dismally.
Yeah. So how many people turned up at this protest?
Ooh, I don't know. A couple of thousand, I suppose.
A couple of thousand?
Yeah, and they filled up the letters and the police just let us close Princess Bridge. I mean.
Yeah. Well, they thought you weren't.
They don't let us close it now when we want to do a demo.
Well, they just thought you were a group of nuts and you may as well just leave you alone.
That's right.
I mean, climate change, who knows what that is?
Yes.
I can't believe this, that you're blaming yourself for the climate emergency. Weren't there generations before us?
Well, they were, but they didn't burn as much as we did. We steadily grew and took it serious. Oh. And, well, we started gas. Our parents would never have heated their homes.
He wouldn't have air conditioning.
No, no air conditioning.
You'd be lucky to have an electric stove.
They had an old wood stove.
Wood stove, yeah. You'd be lucky to have a telephone.
Well, I had telephones down there, yeah.
Did they? Yeah. Barron beat that telephone.
Yeah, and our number was 513, I think.
So what did your wife think about her husband going out on Princess Bridge and organising a letter?
Well, it's interesting. She's always supported me in what I did, but she's never joined in herself.
Right.
She agrees that it needs to be done,
right.
But she leaves it to me to do the work.
Well,
then
no,
she just tells all the stories afterwards to all our friends.
Yeah, and they laugh.
You're listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned to hear the rest of your 3CR podcast.
Look, it's 4:30. We're chatting to Ellen Cuthbertson, a Liberal Party voter and a PhD. I've forgotten what the PhD was in, but he's into physics and all of a sudden he saw the light. He read an article in The Age on climate change and he was out there on Princess Street Bridge. So what letter were you?
I can't remember.
You can't remember?
No, I can't remember.
Can't remember any people you were marshalling?
No, we just drew lines on the ground and everyone had to fill up the holes.
In chalk, I hope.
Yeah.
You wouldn't put paint.
No paint.
It caused problems. All right, so that was your first action.
Mm-hmm.
And what did you think about it?
Well, I thought we'd solve the world. I mean, once people saw our sign, they'd think climate change was serious and do something about it.
Look, between you and me, who'd give a shit?
Yeah.
And two, nobody would know what 350.org was, would they?
Oh, in those days, they were high on the agenda.
What, for a few thousand people?
Yeah.
I mean, did you get a picture in The Age at least?
It would have been a picture in the age, yes.
Yeah, 350.org.
Yeah.
So if we go back to the late 1980s.
Well, no, that'd be the 2000.
2000?
2005, probably.
So it took you from 1952 to 2005 to get involved in your first demonstration.
That's right. I was 50 before I went down my first demo.
What, did you see the writing on the wall for yourself or the planet or both?
The planet was what I was waiting for.
All right. Okay, so you've done this action. What happens next?
Well, I got more involved in 350.org and then Stop Adani came along.
Who?
Stop Adani? Yes, that was the big thing. No, to stop the Adani coal mine up in Queensland.
Never heard of it.
Well, it was the big thing. And
was it?
It was interesting because it was probably the most organised protest movement that they started up.
And but this was 350.org or Stop Adani?
350 had sort of died away a little bit by then.
Right.
But Stop Adani sprang out and a lot of them would move between groups and Stop Adani, they had a very clear things to stop the coal mine.
Why would you stop a nice multinational corporation digging for coal, which wasn't even very good? Why would you bother?
It was terrible coal.
Right.
And I mean, they'd known the coal was there for years.
Yeah.
And they'd never bothered digging it up because it was just too...
What, Clive Palmer never got involved?
No, it was before. Yeah, it was Adani from.
Yeah, I know that, but he didn't even bother.
He bought another mine up there.
All right.
And that was part of the concern. If the Adani mine went ahead, they'd build a railway line to the coal port.
Yeah.
And once they've built the railway line, the other mines are likely to develop. So the stopping Adani was aimed at trying to achieve that.
So, did you have an executive position in this feral organisation?
Oh, just local in the Eltham branch.
Eltham branch.
Yes, and we're
very nice to see you living in Eltham. Yeah,
and we would protest outside the Commonwealth Bank in Eltham.
Why the Commonwealth Bank?
Oh, because they were supporting Adani.
Well, they were giving them money.
They were giving them money. Yeah.
Well, they're the most profitable bank in Australia.
Right. Support everyone.
Shares are $300 each. When it was privatised in the 1980s by the Labor government, they sold the shares for about $3.25.
Right.
So, you know, why wouldn't they give money to Adani?
That's right. And they were giving money to that and we would protest outside their thing. Yeah. I do remember we did a tour. We went to the Eltham branch and protested there, then caught the train in and on all various banks on the way in.
Yeah.
We got to Heidelberg and occupied their branch.
Right.
And the lady that was in charge was horrified. She'd lost control of her branch and demanded that we leave.
Uh-huh.
And we refused and she said, we'll call the police. And we said, yeah, you can do that.
Yeah.
And the police came along. We had a sign out the front, toot if you want to stop Adani.
Yeah.
And the police car tooted.
Right.
And then they came in and spoke to us and said, look, you better leave. So we all walked out.
Okay.
So we didn't get arrested then.
Well, you know, the good thing if you did the same protest today is there are a few Commonwealth branches to actually picket because they're closing down half of them. So there you go. They've actually made it easier for your protesters.
Yes.
All right. Well, this seems pretty straightforward, you know. There's nothing too radical about this. You didn't lose your job, did you?
No. Well, by that stage, well, I was self-employed anyway.
All right.
Yeah. I'd actually...
Makes a difference, doesn't it? I've been self-employed since the early 80s, and it makes all the difference, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, about the same time, I couldn't get a job computing because that had sort of gone downhill a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Concerned about climate change, and I was retrofitting my house.
Retrofitting
it. So I'd picked up all the insulation in the house, blocked all the drafts, and then decided to change the glass to make it.
Excuse me, what did the kids think about all this?
Oh, they just thought I was a bit mad.
You did this all by yourself?
Yes. I was all pretty simple. It didn't really impact them much.
All right. Okay.
So I took the sheet of glass out and put in a double glazed unit.
Uh-huh.
So it cost me about $5,000 rather than $60,000.
Yep, because you did it. Yeah.
And then I decided this is a good business. So I started up my own business selling double glazing for 10 years.
Double glazing.
So we
to
would
houses.
Just, yep.
What would you sell it or fit it?
We'd sell it and fit it. The original idea was that we'd sell it and the people would fit it themselves.
Uh-huh.
But I soon found out that most people weren't game to fit glass into a window.
No, you don't want to kill yourself with the glass breaking.
Well, I'd occasionally cut myself.
Occasionally. Yeah. Is that why you've only got 9 fingers,
that's
I noticed?
Right.
Yeah. You lost a finger. All right, so this during these 10 years you were self-employed doing double glazing, you know, fitting double glazing windows, I assume you're employing people?
No, I ended up employing a couple of people.
Right.
But most, it was sort of a, I mean, I just ran it from home.
Uh-huh.
And it was good because there was no stock.
Right.
I didn't employ anyone.
Right.
And if people rang up and wanted double glazing, I could make a living. If they didn't, I could just continue as a retired person.
How old were you?
Oh, I would have been about 60.
So you're relying on superannuation?
Well, yeah. Mm. I mean, as I said, I went very well as contracting. It was a good lurk.
Right.
So it paid for our house. We had it paid off our house.
Uh-huh.
Had a bit of super.
Educate the kids and all that stuff.
That's right.
Yeah. All right. Sounds pretty idyllic. Here you are. You got a business. You're making a buck. Did you do anything during those 10 years apart from try to change the world by double glazing houses?
Well, I got involved with the predecessor of Rising Tide up in Newcastle.
Newcastle? What were you doing in Newcastle?
We went up there to block the coal ships was the basic idea.
When was that?
Oh, it would have been 2012, I'd think.
You wanted to block the coal ships?
Yes, we went up there and we just stood on the bank and waved to them, basically.
Right.
And they just kept going, so they didn't stop for us.
They didn't stop for us?
They didn't stop, no.
They didn't read the summons?
No.
Maybe it was a foreign crew and they couldn't read English. You ever thought of that?
Yeah.
Maybe you should have had, you know, multilingual signs.
But there was a splinter group that went and sat on the railway line and blocked the coal trains.
I remember that splinter group.
Yes.
And they paid
they
heavily.
Very effective.
And they paid heavily for that, didn't they?
Well, I don't think they were
arrested
by the courts, or they were arrested.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's surprising how, you know, generous, I suppose, how supportive the courts are of protesters.
Well, they were, since the... I mean, the thing is, we could... You know, I'm making light of this, but obviously things escalate, and if we go to 2020 and 2025, all these new laws that have been introduced by state and federal governments, which criminalise activity... which is legitimate protest activity, like occupations.
Yeah, well, that was the thing. Last year I went up for the Rising Tide thing where there was 170 of us arrested for blocking a coal ship, and they did bring in those draconian laws and applied them to us because it was blocking a coal ship, which was critical infrastructure for Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're facing fines of $20,000 for that. But I doubt it'll get that far.
It's still in court. That one's still in court,
yes,
is it?
Just in through court. They're having a couple of test cases to see what will happen with it.
Right. Are you one of the test cases?
No, I'm not one of the test cases.
No. Once again, you're one of the Indians.
That's right. Well, you see, I wasn't a good test case for it because I had previous convictions, you see. So once you've got previous convictions...
Excuse me. Excuse me. Here we've got a businessman, a PhD, an activist... Previous convictions. Please explain, sir.
Well, I've been... XR was the
XR,
big
what's
Extinction
that?
Rebellion.
I know that,
Mob. In fact,
Mob,
I was one of the founding members of Extinction Rebellion.
Where? In Australia or Melbourne?
In Australia.
Melbourne
in particular.
How did that start?
There was probably a group of half a dozen of us.
Yeah.
Came out of other groups. I think FLAC, which was Frontline Action on Coal,
uh-huh.
a few of us, because this was when Extinction Rebellion kicked off in England.
Mm-hmm.
And their first thing was very successful.
Yep.
And we thought we can do the same in Melbourne. So it was about seven or eight of us joined together, had a meeting down in the city, and started the group up from there.
Now, can you tell us where in the city so we can put up a plaque?
Yeah, well, it was in the Fed Square.
Fed Square.
A little Fed Square there.
You realise that's privatised space.
Is it? Yes.
It's not public space.
Well, you can still use privatised space.
Well, it is privatised space because what happens with... Well, we did a struggle there for years to point that out because it's actually subletted to a private organisation to manage it for the state government for a fee.
Right.
And every time you go there, if you want to protest, you can be kicked off because it is. There's no public space left in Melbourne, no public space except in front of the state library. That's why people gather there.
I must admit, we've never protested at Fed Square. Maybe
That's what you need. That'll be the reason. Obviously, there are saner people than you if you're multiple convictions. All right. Now, tell me about these convictions. Are you allowed to talk about them?
Yeah.
All right. Are you not ashamed of them?
No.
Is it a badge of honour, is it?
It is. In fact, I've got my T-shirt on.
Climate Defended Arrested Extinction Rebellion. Oh. We've got a radical here, Daryl. I don't know what we're going to do, mate. Will we continue with the interview?
Yeah. Oh, look, get more of them in, I think.
More of them in, all right.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Well, what have you been arrested for?
Oh, basically sitting on a roadway and refusing to leave.
You refuse an order to leave?
That's right. And then we'd lie down and they'd have to carry you off.
Oh, good thing about you is you wouldn't be more than 80 kilos, would you?
That's right.
They have to carry me off. They need a bulldozer.
They normally get four policemen, one on each leg. One on each arm, and one holds your head.
Yeah, we've got one of the activists we know very well is called Elizabeth Matthews, and she does a radical philosophy program here in 3CR. And when they had the protests, not World Forum, but after that, she was dragged away. She's a big woman, by four police officers in the old Melbourne city square, which has now been disappeared because the railway works. And one of her breasts fell out of her bra, and there she is on mainstream television. And they're carrying her off, and she loves it. She loves it. She says it was a highlight of her life. Good on you, Liz, if you're listening. So, right, and what, all fines, no jail time?
No, they all went to court.
Yep.
But it's interesting because you get it before court and the judge would normally...
The magistrate. Let's get it right. Yes, you didn't get to county court, did you?
No, I didn't get to county court.
Right.
The magistrate would normally sort of give the little lecture of you're allowed to protest, but you've got to do it legally, et cetera. But then they dismiss it without penalty.
Yeah, right.
So that's happened five times now.
Five times. Mm. So you've been arrested five times, charged five times.
Technically, I've been arrested 17 times.
What do you mean, technically?
Well, most of them are just... catch and release, if you like.
Catch and release.
They grab you, take you off the road and then let you go.
A little bit like a feral animal.
Yeah.
Catch and release. Or a snake. Yeah. All right. So you don't have a conviction.
You still get a conviction.
Ah.
But that doesn't really affect me much because I don't want to go to America.
Well, last time I was in court, we had a stalemate. And we had no conviction, no fine. No court costs. But I still didn't win.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing.
Yeah.
The court system isn't really about providing justice.
No.
It's just about providing a solution to a problem.
Mm.
And so you go in there, they agree that if you plead guilty, we'll just let you off without a fine.
Mm. Yeah.
So you take that option rather than saying, I'll plead not guilty, take it to court, spend weeks, multiple days in court.
Yeah, it took me 17 appearances for that one.
That'd be right. Okay. And you end up probably with the same result. I mean, we can't get much better than no fine.
Yeah.
But it's just I do have a record now.
You got a record. Felon. Didn't you check this bloke's style? Didn't you check this bloke's criminal record? Because we don't interview criminals.
Well, I found out he was an activist. I went no further.
Well, I thought maybe because I gave you the wrong surname. I said Cuthbert, not Cuthbertson.
Couldn't find any record of
him. No, I couldn't find any record. But being serious, so you think climate, the extinction mob, they've had their time?
It's difficult to say. I mean, we grew very quickly at the start and got a lot of people, and we sort of thought everyone will come on board and we'll all be out there. Thousands of people protesting on the streets.
Yeah.
It hasn't gone that way. We've sort of settled on, we've probably got about 150 members.
Right.
And probably 20 who are quite active. We can still run a good demo though.
Right.
I was doing one 2 or 3 months ago where we got a large hay bale on the back of a trailer.
Yeah.
Got on Princess Bridge and rolled the hay bale off.
Right.
Tipped it on its side, put a placard over it, a tent over it, and two of us sat inside with our arms locked onto a pipe through the middle of the hay bale.
Uh-huh. Well, we can deal a few mob now with the change of legislation, the lock-on legislation.
Well, that's the thing. It is getting more serious.
Yeah, it is getting more serious.
But it's still up to the courts where they actually inflict those penalties.
Right, yeah, it is. There's that. Well, you know that report that came out yesterday or the day before that said this climate emergency crap is real.
Mm.
What do you think about that?
Well, I haven't had a chance to read it. I've been away for a few days.
Well, hang on. Have you been preparing for this interview by going away?
That's right.
Where'd you go?
Went down to Apollo Bay
with
the walking club.
With the walking club?
Yes. I'm in the
average age?
Oh, 65 to 85. Well, my eldest is 93. He's about the fastest of a lot of us.
He's 93 and he's the walking club.
Mm-hmm.
Could you ask him his secrets?
Well, joining a walking club, I think.
Oh, is he fit?
He's very fit.
It means I have to lose weight, doesn't it?
Mm.
All right, so you're in the walking club in the Otway. So you have, this minister was carrying on about how serious this is.
Yes.
Well, giving us all these crappy facts, you know, like a million households are going to be underwater, people are going to die because of increased temperature, more bushfires, floods. And what they forgot is more viruses as the heat increases.
There's a whole lot of collateral damage that we haven't thought about. And that's what came out of COVID. Things happened in COVID that we never expected to happen.
Mm.
And climate change will be the same. Yes, it'll heat up and we turn up our heaters and we don't worry about the temperature. But food production will change. Seas won't provide as much fish as they do now. Yeah. There'll be whole areas which sort of collapse because of it. And once one country collapses or one industry in a country collapses, that's when you get domino effects where it all goes over.
So do you think that all the effort you and like-minded people have put into this over the last 20 to 30 years has been worth it?
Well, it's hard to say. We don't know the results. I think we have moved attitudes. We haven't moved them as far as we'd want to. But my feeling is that doesn't matter. You sort of have to do it. As I said before, we sort of caused it. It's our job to try and do something about it.
No. You got it wrong, mate. We're the boomer generation.
We're the boomer generation. It doesn't matter.
Our job is to spend all that money in our superannuation accounts so we don't leave any to our children and grandchildren to deal with the climate emergency. That's our job. Cruises, holidays to Europe.
Yes.
What else can we do? A new car.
I bought a new car.
I want to ask him. He's following it. We actually owe the younger generations.
We definitely do.
What do you mean?
Well, you owe it to your kids, your grandchildren.
What? Why?
Well, it's a good point. I suppose it's an assumption I make.
Right.
That we should leave the world in a better place.
You're kidding.
Yeah, we don't own the world. We just...
We don't own it?
No, we're just custodians of it for our lifetime.
Custodians?
Yes, and we should leave it better than we started.
What, you reckon Elon Musk and... Twiggy Forrest and Gina Reinhardt own the world and we just, you know.
Well, no, I don't think that. They definitely don't own the world. They just have a large slice of money, but that's it.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking a few weeks ago, it's dangerous to think, I was thinking about the Bible and that famous phrase that the meek will inherit the earth. You know, it's not happening. You know why?
No.
85% of Australians are now cremated when they die. You don't even inherit the earth anymore.
That's right.
What do you think of the economic changes and the grip that large corporations have on the type of legislation which goes through Parliament?
It's a concern that, democracy, it's the best that we've got. I mean, I'd prefer to have a benevolent dictator, if you like.
All right. I'm happy. Look, I'll put up my hand. I'm happy. You can vote me in as your benevolent dictator.
Well, that's the trouble, is that most benevolent dictators don't stay benevolent.
No, they don't. No, we tend to line our pockets.
So democracy is about the only thing left. But the problem with democracy is that we're too much influenced by short-term things. We don't really know enough about who we're voting for. And so sometimes we end up with the wrong answer.
Yeah, well, what's your definition of democracy?
Oh, I suppose just everyone, one man, one vote. That's a good start.
No.
And one woman as well.
No, nothing like that. So people say democracy is rule of the people, by the people, for the people.
Yes, they do.
But there is one sentence they forget, a few words. It should be, it's rule of the people, by the people, for the people, by an engaged public.
Right, yes.
And that's the issue, isn't it? The public is not engaged.
And they don't want to be engaged.
Well, it's not about not wanting to be engaged, is that people... You know, their livelihoods are basically attached to a wage system, whether you're self-employed or whether you're working for somebody else. And if you don't have a wage in a capitalist society, you end up like poor Daryl on the dole, right? And that limits your opportunities. And so I think while we continue to rely on a wage system, that people won't be engaged. They won't care.
Yes.
It's not in their interest, is it?
No.
No. So obviously I think... People who are involved in, you know, the climate emergency campaigns need to think a little bit wider in terms of the strategy, because it's a little bit like the timber industry. If you're going to close down the timber industry, you need to offer some alternative to people whose whole lives is dependent on the income they make from the timber industry. And if you don't address that, you get blowback all the time.
It's true.
Yeah.
But I don't think we've got enough time to solve the political problems.
Hang on.
Before we start looking at the climate change problems. Well, so we've got to use what we've got now to do the best we can.
Right.
And you can manipulate the capitalist theory and the profit motive to actually, I mean, once you get climate, once you get the solution is cheaper than what they've got now, the business will leap in and do it.
Yeah, but what I've noticed is what business is doing is the same companies and they're using the same centralised model for energy production. It's not about decentralised energy production. It's about them controlling the whole process of producing energy.
Yes.
Yeah, so that's an issue. Well, that's an issue we can debate. Now, you're an old man. You've been around a while. You do a little bit of walking. There may be one or two listeners under 40 listening to this program. Have you got any advice to them?
Work hard, I suppose, but I think we do have to concentrate on climate change. It is the most critical thing we've got, and it's easy to say, I can't fix it. That's true. One person can't solve it. But there's lots of things they can do just by getting rid of gas, getting an electric car, doing stuff which actually does make a difference at that level.
Yeah, but all these things require assets.
Mm-hmm. But not as much assets as it used to be.
No, I agree. I mean, you know, solar panels, the price has come down. The government rebates. But a lot of people aren't in a position to actually access that technology. It's all very well talking about electric cars. I was looking at car prices recently, and although they've come down, especially the Chinese electric cars, down to about, what, 40, 45,000?
They're under 40 now, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But that, if you had to go out and buy a car, it's cheaper now, or as cheap, to buy an electric car as a petrol car.
Right.
So that's the decision you should make, is to buy an electric car. And the same thing with gas. Yes, it does cost money to get off gas. I always sort of think those people that spend 20 grand a year going on holidays, going on trips overseas, in indulgences, if you like.
Indulgences. Sounds like things very Catholic. Indulgences.
Things they don't have to buy.
You want us to make sacrifices.
That's right.
But unfortunately, a lot of people don't have holidays, and they're not in a position to actually see. One third of Australians, I'm not making excuses, but one third of Australians rely on social security benefits to survive. That just basically, you need government intervention to assist people.
That's true.
To move into those areas, especially those people who don't have the resources.
But there are. I mean, it should be possible for someone to take it on and say, I'll buy you the solar panels.
Right.
And you pay me back with time.
Right.
And there's still, that's one way that you could do it to address those issues. I realise it's a problem. It's a problem with rental people because they don't own their property.
Yep.
But there's people that can afford it and they're the ones that should contribute. And they should be, if they can't, once they've converted their own houses, buy things for their kids.
So we've got about 4 or 5 minutes left. What do you want to do in the few years that are left to you?
That's an interesting question. Probably just keep doing what I am and protesting. I think I'll always protest now.
Always?
Yeah.
From liberal voting businessman
yes,
to permanent protester.
Permanent protester.
Yeah. Do you think it does anything?
Look, I don't know. All I know is that not doing anything doesn't achieve anything.
That's right.
And hopefully protesting does make an influence.
Yeah, it's a bit like preparing for a bushfire or a flood. You can either prepare or you can actually just say, when it comes, it comes.
Yeah.
I do think protesting does make a difference.
It does.
It's small, but it does make a difference because it forces people to address things. But I think maybe increasing disasters may, you know, get people to think about it. Although these days I've noticed that when there is a disaster, they keep talking about a 1 in 100 year disaster or a 1 in 1,000 year disaster, and it's got nothing to do with the climate emergency. It's just a disaster.
And it happens every 5 years, but it's still a 1 in 100 disaster.
Yeah. That's right, yeah.
People are, well, I suppose they put their head in the sand.
So you got no plans for overseas trips and
nah.
Going down the Danube in a ship? No.
We did
going to the Sofitel with Daryl tonight for a free course meal?
We went over to Ningaloo to have a look at the roof.
Uh-huh.
And it is sad how much that is deteriorating already.
Right.
Yeah. But we thought we'd have a look at it before it all went.
Yeah. Well, that's one thing, isn't it? All those beautiful things we're used to as younger people, you know, when we go to all the beaches and drive around Australia in our panel vans and, you know, they'll all disappear.
Yep.
they won't be there for our kids and grandkids.
That's right.
You know, we'll show them about the glories of the Great Barrier Reef on a video. Yeah, it'll be a little bit like... Yeah.
Well, we'll go down to the aquarium.
Go down to the aquarium. Yeah. Look at the seahorses. Right. Well, so you've got plans to grow old disgracefully.
That's right.
Not gracefully.
No, not gracefully.
And you're not going to shut up.
No.
Really? Is there any websites or that you could recommend that people who kind of feel that they need to follow you, like you follow that Age article, could access?
I don't really have much to do on the internet.
No, but
there's
a lot
of stuff there, and there's a lot of rubbish there.
Yeah. Do you any stuff that you would recommend?
Not really.
So what do you recommend?
I suppose to listen to the scientists. They know what they're talking about with climate change.
So you reckon this report is real?
Yeah.
You reckon this is what we face?
That's right, if not worse.
Well, the coalition said we don't need to worry about it.
Yeah. Well, you see, that's the thing. We talk about not exceeding 1.5 degrees.
Yeah.
We've already passed it.
You're kidding.
Yeah, it's happened, I think, 2 years now. 1 year was so close. Then last year we exceeded 1.5. And once you get past it, you never get back. So I'd think 3 or 4 degrees would be a good result, to be honest.
3 or 4 degrees?
Oh, yeah. If we can keep it under 4 degrees, I think we're doing well.
You're not being alarmist, are you?
No, I'm being just honest, I'd say.
What, looking at the facts?
Yes.
What
I mean, when we've reached 1.5 degrees and we're still increasing, increasing faster than ever before,
right?
You haven't even got to the peak. And if you haven't got to the peak, there's a tail which is just as wide.
Right.
I mean, that's just the simple...
That sounds factual.
Yes.
You really think we need to worry about facts?
We have to. And that's the other thing. Net zero is a bit of a con.
Uh-huh. Why?
Well, we've got to get to zero, not net zero.
Oh, right.
Net zero is just an accounting trick.
Right.
And zero is what we have to... Because it's only when zero... When we get to zero, the solution... The problem isn't fixed. It just stops getting worse at that stage.
Right.
So if we get to zero, things will continue at whatever temperature we're at then forever, unless you start drawing CO2 out of the atmosphere.
Look, Darryl, we've got to thank Alan Cuthbertson for coming on and educating us and using facts. I'd just like to remind you, Alan, this is the end of the first quarter of the 21st century. Society doesn't believe in facts. Nature does, and it doesn't care what happens to us. And that's the key, isn't it? It doesn't care.
That's right.
And doesn't care what our belief systems are, who our gods are. Ultimately, it decides our fate.
Right. And I do worry that whether the human race is capable of solving the problem.
Well, maybe we are, maybe we're not. If not, we can join Mr. Musk in a trip to Mars.
Yes.
Thank you, Darryl.
Yep, you're welcome, Joe. Okay, you have been listening to Radical Australia with presenter Joe Toscano and special guest Alan Cuthbertson.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.